Hello, I'm Jimmy Lin. This is number 0358, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0358. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Zane Busby from the Survivor Mitzvah Project. Her organization helps those forgotten survivors of the Holocaust who live in Eastern Europe. This whole project started from a vacation she took a decade ago.
My mother actually suggested, she said, why don't you go, instead of going to Hawaii, why don't you go to Eastern Europe and see where your grandmothers were from? And I thought, oh, okay. So I did that. And while looking for my roots, I found the situation with Holocaust survivors where they were, you know, elderly, alone, in hostile communities with no heat and no food and no government to help them, no reparations from Germany, no lifeline. And I thought, whoa, what's wrong with this? This is terrible.
Actress Michael Learned of Walton's fame is back in Canada once again, starring in the play Driving Miss Daisy in Petrolia, Ontario.
People love this play, and I do too. I never get tired of it. It's astonishing to me because you think of it as a rather light play, and it isn't. It's about very deep things. It's about love, it's about connection, it's about unconscious biases that we all have, and it's funny, it's touching, it's everything.
Stuart Nolman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman, and this time Book Banter presents a special edition called Remembrance of Summer Reads Past. So get ready for some of my favorite Beach and Balcony books coming up soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0358 was Jimmy Lin, an accounting student at McGill University. Thank you very much, Jimmy, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Now, there are many reasons why someone would have the need to call 911, and while the Stuff File program has often brought you stories where the calls were frivolous, this is not one of those calls. Oh, but it is highly unique.
Wayne County 911, where's your emergency?
I have a serious problem. My neighbor sold me a deep freezer. I just opened it, and there's a body in there, I think.
Your neighbor sold it to you?
I'm freaking out.
I understand, ma'am. Your neighbor sold it to you?
Yes.
The caller had bought the freezer with the understanding that she couldn't use it for a while because it was being used for a time capsule, but the seller said a church group would pick up the contents. After waiting 3 weeks for a church group that never came, the caller opened the duct tape freezer. She said, I saw toes and a foot and an ankle. She slammed the lid, then opened it again and finally believed the corpse was real. Goldsboro, North Carolina police said she was right, and they're investigating, even though the medical examiner says the person died of natural causes. The reason they're investigating is because the treatment of the corpse may have been a criminal act. Yes, it may have been criminal, and it's also somewhat, shall we say, cold. Yeah. And speaking of 911 calls, again, if you listen to the Stuff File program regularly or read my blog, then you know that I have often warned about the dangers of cats. They are evil. Little pieces of evil plotting against mankind. Well, yet another story in the news makes my argument. A couple in Wisconsin called 911 after their cat's wild behavior left them feeling like hostages in their own home.
It's going to sound like a strange question, but we have a cat and it's going crazy and it's attacked my husband, and we're kind of hostage in our house, and we're just wondering who we can call to do something, get rid of the cat, or help us?
Police responded to the home in Greenfield when a woman called to report that her pet cat had attacked her husband and sought help in having the animal removed. Neither the woman nor her husband were seriously injured by the cat, which was ultimately captured and placed in custody of the Milwaukee Area Domestic Animal Control Commission. You see, I keep warning you folks, but you never listen. Of course, you'll realize the error of your ways when it will be too late. Yes. And police responded to reports of shots fired in the Holiday Office Park building in Cincinnati, Ohio. The building was evacuated, and officers traced the origin of the shots to the second floor, where a movie audition was being held. One of the actors, trying for a part using method acting, brought a blank gun unbeknownst to anybody on the production set, said Police Captain Maurice Robinson. He fired off a number of blank rounds, and for the remainder of the building, it sounded like real gunfire. The man was charged with inducing panic. No injuries were reported, said Robinson. He just got overly enthusiastic about trying to get the part. Well, I'm going on the assumption that he might be spending some time on a location shoot with extras he might not find too friendly to work with. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Tennessee wedding took an unexpected turn when a sparkler held by a guest caused the bride's hair to burst into flames. The video, filmed at a wedding in Munford, Tennessee, shows the bride and groom exiting the ceremony under a canopy of sparklers held over their heads by wedding guests. The bride passes too close to one of the fireworks and ends up with the back of her head in flames. The flames are extinguished, and the happy couple try their exit again, this time making sure to tell guests to hold the sparklers high up in the air. Okay, seriously. If your head just became a human torch at your own wedding because of sparklers, after you've been put out, would you really want to redo the scene by giving guests another chance to light your head up again? I mean, how do you know the first time wasn't premeditated? Seriously. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Zane Busby is a well-respected and successful TV director who has been at the helm of over 200 episodes of network television, including such hits as Golden Girls, Newhart, and Married with Children. But she is also the driving force behind a movement to help survivors of the Holocaust still living in Eastern Europe. It's called the Survivor Mitzvah Project, and there is an amazing one-hour TV special called The Last Survivors, Echoes from the Holocaust. Zane joins us on the line right now from California to talk about the project. Hi, Zane.
Hello, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thank you very much for being on the program with us. You know, I watched this special earlier today, and all I can say is, wow, it is just so moving.
Oh, thank you so much. I mean, I've seen it many, many times myself and, of course, worked on it. It moves me every single time, every time, because it's just, you know, the stories of these survivors are so emotional and so touching and so life-affirming.
In putting this together, and we'll talk a little bit about that, how that was done, but in putting this together and being where you are now and doing so much to help these people, is it kind of bittersweet to think that maybe, you know, collectively we could have done this sooner?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, see, you said I'm a comedy director, so I just took a two-week vacation, you know, over 10 years ago. And my mother actually suggested, she said, why don't you go, instead of going to Hawaii, why don't you go to Eastern Europe and see where your grandmothers were from? And I thought, oh, okay. So I did that. And while looking for my roots, I found the situation with Holocaust survivors where they were, you know, elderly, alone, in hostile communities with no heat and no food and no government to help them, no reparations from Germany, no lifeline. And I thought, whoa. What's wrong with this? This is terrible, you know? And so, of course, I gave them as much money that I had on me, and then I just started to write to them. I didn't even know how to communicate because I don't know these languages. I would just wrap up money and, you know, in a piece of paper and send it off, hoping that they would at least know someone out there cares. And it grew and it grew, and then I went back and found more people, and from the first 8 people, it's now over 2,000 people in 8 countries. And I just got back from another trip trying to find people, and to think that they've been out there for 70 years suffering, 70 years after the, you know, the war, it just blows my mind. So now when you finally bring them kindness and compassion and money, of course, so they can get food, heat, and medication, but the kindness and the compassion and the knowledge that they've not been forgotten, well, that is equally as life-saving.
And you talk about 70 years of suffering. For those who are older, it's even longer than that. I know in the special, you were on stage talking to the audience, and you bring up the point of those who were born in 1929 and all the suffering they have seen through the years from one ordeal to another. It's like never ending.
Right. This is what I call the unluckiest generation. I mean, if you think about it, we've had people who were born in 1905, 1910, 1918. So as children or as young people, you know, they were under the Tsarist rule. So that, then there's the Russian Revolution, destruction, loss of parents. A lot of them were orphaned, whatever. Say they survived. They survived that. And suddenly here they are living in the 1920s where there are enforced famines by Stalin. That's when, like, hundreds of thousands of people came to the United States. But the ones who stayed and survived the famines, you know, then were stuck during Stalinization. And then the war started, and if they survived the initial blow into their country, well, then, of course, the Einsatzgruppen came in 1940, and that was the mobile killing squad to roared into every town and villages across Eastern Europe, killing every man, woman, and child in their path who were Jewish, torching their villages and moving on to the next massacre. Thousands and thousands of villages and God, millions of people were killed like this. And if they survived that, you know, then there's the full-blown Holocaust to survive. They survived that after the war when the, you know, the nations of the world carved up Eastern Europe. They were caught behind the Iron Curtain, where it was, again, a crime to be Jewish, a crime to own a Jewish book, a crime to speak their own language. If they survived that, came a few kind of what I call the good years by Russian standards, you know, with the long lines that we used to, you know, read about in the 60s, and, you know, not such great years, but at least there was no war. And then came Chernobyl, where very unreported in this country, the devastation that took place over there in Belarus and Ukraine. I mean, the entire caregiver generation, like my generation, who would have older parents now, you know, they were killed. They have cancer, you know, so they're not helping their parents because they're dying, or they died off already. And if they survived all that, came perestroika, which we think, oh, it's wonderful, you know, Eastern Europe opened up to the West. But for them, it meant they went to sleep one night, and then every penny saved was taken from them, and by the next morning, they were bankrupt. So these are people who have not had one, you know, good break, the unluckiest generation by far. And then they were forgotten by the world. And so it's amazing that they're not bitter and crazy, but they're not.
And it's funny you say that, they're not bitter and crazy, because the one sense of hope I got watching your special was at every time, especially the women, every time I saw scenes with you talking and looking at women, they had such a cheerful look on their face. And I'm sure a lot of that has to do with what you have been doing, but there was just such a sense of hope after
all
they've been
through. Well, you know, that's the whole thing, and that's really what they teach you. And, you know, you kind of know it going in, but, you know, when you really see it and you go, oh, my God, this is really how we should all be living, they believe that kindness and compassion is the most important thing in life. These are people who have had everything burned and taken from them, their families, their photographs. You know, they don't remember what their parents' face looks like. They don't remember what their children's faces look like. They don't have any photographs, musical instruments, old letters, nothing. So things mean nothing to them, right? But kindness and compassion means everything to them. So they say things like, you know, like here's a great example. When the financial, you know, breakdown came in 2008, you know, they hear about it on the radio or TV, and they wrote letters to me, and they said things like, oh, we understand that your country is totally broken. You are poor now, so don't send us any money. But please, 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 let's not lose our connection, you know. And they would write things like, you know, if you want to help someone and you don't have any money, just put a kind hand on a shoulder or say a kind word. So this is what they believe, because each one of them was saved by an act of kindness or compassion. A piece of bread was thrown at them. They were hidden in a cellar by someone. You know, someone let them pass through a forest and didn't, like, report them. You know, every single person who's alive now during the Holocaust is here because of an act of kindness and compassion towards their fellow man, and usually a stranger. So they believe kindness and compassion towards strangers is the most important thing in life. And that's a great thing to carry around with you, because every day you can go out in the world and be kind to somebody and know that it's really changing their lives.
The TV show, the TV special, have features the likes of Ed Asner, Frances Fisher, Elliot Gould, Valerie Harper, Leni Kazan, and Alan Rosenberg. And they are reading some of the letters that you have received. They're on stage reading some of the letters that you have received from these people who are Holocaust survivors. And I know the show is edited, it's cut down. I'm just wondering how you guys got through those letters without just bursting into tears.
Well, you know, it was an amazing thing. We got to do this show like almost on the spur of the moment. And we got the opportunity to, we were invited by the Simon Wiesenthal Center. So we put this show together kind of like in our heads. We didn't have any money to actually do it like you would normally do a show with rehearsals and, you know, editing. So we have so many letters that are so important, but I tried to find letters that would each illuminate a different part of the Holocaust and a different kind of experience. Some were hidden. Some, you know, fought as brave partisans in the forest of Belarus as teenagers. They fought the Nazis. Can you imagine? You know, some were in the ghettos. Some jumped the fences in the ghettos and lived wild in the forest. You know, there were all the some went to Central Asia. They were evacuated to Central Asia where they were, you know, starved. So some spent the war years in crazy places. And I tried to just like just give a little slice of life to, you know, to each, shine a light rather on each part of the Holocaust so people could see that the Holocaust in the East is not really about concentration camps. It's about the 100 other types of experiences people had. Because this is different than the Holocaust that we know about Auschwitz and Dachau and all of the concentration camps. You know, so this was really important to get a wide variety of letters. And then I thought of the actors, and I thought, well, who would be good for this character? Who would be good for that? Because I know the actual survivors. And then we just had time to really race through the letters in like an hour and a half rehearsal. No one really, you know, got to work on it. I told them about the survivors. And then when they read them on stage, you can see the other actors sitting watching their fellow actors are crying. I mean, absolutely. I mean, Frances Fisher, you could see tears roll down her face when she's watching Valerie Harper. You can see Valerie Harper cry when, you know, Ed Asner's on the stage or Frances Fisher is on the stage, because it all hit us like a ton of bricks, because none of us had heard this come together before except the night that it happened. It was one of those magical nights where everything, you know, worked perfectly, you know, without any rehearsal.
How many times have you been back to Eastern Europe?
Many times. I just got back a couple of weeks ago from Belarus and Lithuania. I've been to Lithuania probably 4 or 5 times. I've been to Belarus probably 4 times. I've been to Ukraine several times. I've been to Latvia. There are places that I still would like to finish Ukraine, because I've been to a lot of Ukraine, but the eastern part of Ukraine is, you know, the survivors that, you know, they say don't come. There's too much war there. You know, that's another thing that's totally underreported. We get letters that sound like they could have been written during World War II. You know, there's bombings, there's killings, there's dead people in the streets, and, you know, it was written yesterday. So there's a lot of war going on in the eastern part of Ukraine, but I would still love to go there to meet, you know, every single person that we help, because it's a mind-blowing experience. And these countries are so much, once you get out into the boondocks, they are exactly the way they were 200 years ago, you know, little tiny, like Fiddler on the Roof, you know, what? Little tiny wooden huts, the crooked lanes, you know, people go to the well to get their water. There's no cars, there's no horses and wagons. So it's a very much an old style existence, which is fascinating to me.
I was going to say, when I first started seeing the video of you, when you went there the first time, the first thing I thought of was like, you're on the set of Fiddler on the Roof. That's exactly what I thought.
I know. I mean, sometimes you walk into a little village and you go, you know, Hollywood could not have made this village look any better.
Yeah.
It's just like you go, wow, this is amazing. But what I found this time, I was looking for, you know, because this stuff is all falling down and there's no restoration, you know, people out there who want to, you know, at least keep a little bit of a village alive or something like that. So it's all being used for firewood now. So I thought I would go back with some cameras and try to capture the last synagogues before they're old. You know, there's only like four left in those areas, and they're old wooden ones falling down, or the last little villages. So we found some villages that were, you know, half burned by the Einsatz group and the mobile killing squads, where you can actually see, you know, how people were dragged out of their houses. The curtains are still there. The bedclothes are still there. It's so eerie, you know, and it really brings the Holocaust home, because you go, oh, my God, you could see that this was like a happy family, you know. Mm. It's a piece of a children's toy, and it's just empty, you know.
I know we initially booked you on this program to talk about the special, because it is being up for an Emmy consideration, which it so richly deserves. I purposely didn't initially talk about that, because that does bring attention to the film, and I think it's the attention to the film that's most important. I think it's something that everyone should have an opportunity to see. People can find out more information by going to your website, which is survivormitzvah.org, correct?
Yes, and mitzvah is spelled M-I-T-Z-V-A-H. At survivormitzvah.org, you can click and watch the special, and you can also watch a lot of other short films that we have made during our humanitarian trips overseas. You can get a really big picture, you can read some of the letters, and you can see all of the actors who've helped us and see their performances as well, because we've had some wonderful actors, and we'll continue. But right now, we are in the 11th hour with these people, and I just want to tell people that, you know, it's so easy right now to save a life. It's so easy to be an angel. It's so easy to have an opportunity to help people who the world turned its back on in 1939. So if you're out there and you want to do something really extraordinary, go to the website, make a donation, and know that you have literally saved a life. It's an amazing feeling.
Zane, thank you.
It's something we can all do together.
Zane, thank you so much for being on the program. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, you too. Thank you so much.
Zane Busby. Again, the organization is the Survivor Mitzvah Project. The TV special, which I truly urge you to watch, is called The Last Survivors: Echoes from the Holocaust. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0358, and you'll find links to both their video and also their website, which shares information on how you can help.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the comic book. It all comes to you here on The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll have a chat with actress Michael Learned, best known for her role as the mother on The Waltons. And Stuart Nauman is in with another edition of Book Banter. Plus, we do indeed have lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, back to the stuff. Police and firefighters responded to a vehicle on fire in La Crosse, Wisconsin. At the scene, an officer spoke to 35-year-old Christopher Johnson, who was drinking a beer on his porch directly in front of the vehicle. Now, according to police reports, Johnson said he had never seen the car, didn't know what happened, and wasn't going to tell the officer anything. Then he went inside. An officer knocked on Johnson's door, and when he answered, he asked whether he could go to jail for setting something on fire. When his girlfriend came into the room, he told her, police say, I set a car on fire. Now, according to the car's owner, he had given Johnson's girlfriend a ride home from a bar, but he'd had too much to drink and left the car behind the house. The man claimed he'd never met the couple. Johnson's girlfriend said Johnson came home and accused her of cheating, then went outside. Johnson's blood alcohol level was allegedly 0.264%, and he was arrested and charged with arson, disorderly conduct, and misdemeanor battery. Yes, alcohol. It's liquid courage and a brain drain all in one. Okay, up next is a story that starts off with a quote. It's a quote from a customer at Costa Coffee in Didsbury, Manchester, England. I was sitting having a coffee when there was a really loud shout. At first, I thought it was just someone messing about, but then I heard some massive bangs. It sounded like shots were being fired. Well, people panicked, and one man dove out of the front window of the cafe, breaking his arm in the process. Again, going back to another witness, when I looked around, I could only see his feet hanging from a window. He was climbing out head first. Now, when a friend of a customer came up the stairs, people realized what had happened. A group of school children had thrown trays on the floor. Our store team worked closely with the Greater Manchester Police regarding this unfortunate incident, Costa Coffee said in a statement. We wish the gentleman involved a speedy recovery. You know, that's not what most people mean when they say they're going to get a coffee and hang out for a while. And remember, folks, jumping out of a window headfirst really only works in the movies. Okay, Milwaukee's WITI-TV, in a man-on-the-scene report from Loretta, Wisconsin, in the state's northwest backwoods in May, described the town's baffling fascination with wood tick racing, which is held annually, provided someone finds enough wood ticks to place in a circle so that townspeople can wager on which one hops out first. The races began 37 years ago, and this year, Howard was declared the winner. According to the organizers, at the end of the day, all contestants except Howard were to be smashed with a mallet. Well, that certainly gave Howard the incentive to win, didn't it? Yes. And Northern Ireland's Belfast Telegraph reported in April that a man was hospitalized after throwing bricks at the front windows of a PIPS office, that's Public Initiative for Prevention of Suicide and Self-Harm. As has happened before to several subjects in such Stuff File program stories, he was injured by brick bounce back off the shatterproof glass. Yes, classically a story of lack of planning and also lack of agility. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, it's time for another all-new episode of Armed and Clumsy, because these folks are always fun. It's people who have accidentally shot themselves recently. Okay, number one, age 37 in Augusta, Kansas, while adjusting his sock gun at a high school graduation. That was in May. Another person, age 28, Panama City, Florida, a jail guard preparing for a job interview. That was also in May. I'm assuming he didn't get the job. An unidentified man in Union, South Carolina, who emerged from a shower, sat on his gun, and shot himself. That was in December. A sheriff of Des Moines County, Iowa, who shot his hand while cleaning his gun in Burlington, Iowa, in December. A moviegoer adjusting his seat in Salina, Kansas, shot himself during the feature. That was in October, and that was only 3 months after acquiring a no-test-required concealed carry permit. At age 43 in Miami, a guy, while demonstrating to a relative how to clean a gun, shot himself in December. And a teenager in Overland, Missouri, trying to take a selfie holding a gun, shot himself in June. And those last two, by the way, are no longer with us. This is how the herd gets thinned. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Four-time Emmy Award-winning actress Michael Learned is best known for the role that brought her three of those Emmys. She played the matriarch Olivia Walton on the hit CBS series The Waltons. This summer, she is spending some time in Canada. In July, she'll star on stage in Driving Miss Daisy, and later in the month, she'll be part of a special event called In Conversation with Michael Learned. Both of those events are taking place at the Victoria Playhouse in Petrolia, Ontario. We've had Michael on the program with us before, and it is a delight to talk to her once again. She joins us on the line from Petrolia. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Thanks for being on the program with us once again.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You seem to have a love affair with playing at the Victoria Playhouse. The last time I spoke to you, you were looking forward to doing another performance at the Petrolia Playhouse several years ago. What is it about the Petrolia Playhouse and that stage in particular that keeps bringing you back?
First of all, my love of Canada. I lived in Toronto for many years. One of my kids was born here. So my young years were spent here, living in Toronto, and being part of the theater community and CBC and many friends and youth. And secondly, but no less importantly, David Hogan and David Rogers, who are the producers and artistic directors of this beautiful theater up here in Petrolia. I just love working with them. They're so professional and so caring and kind. So I love working. In fact, we're in rehearsal right now for Driving Miss Daisy with a wonderful Canadian cast, and we're just having a ball. We're working hard, but it's fun to be working. If that makes any sense.
I understand it completely. Now, as I mentioned, you've done Driving Miss Daisy before, so do you discover new things about the character when you return to the role, especially after a period of time?
Every time. In fact, this time, I've been embarrassed. I said, God, we never explored that. I've done it more than once. And I did it in Sarnia with this same producers. David Hogan didn't direct that production, but I said, God, I feel like I've never really explored this play, but it's only because it is kind of, there are new things to find every time because there's a new hook and a new bully. And so I try to erase the past and the past productions and just be in the present in this incarnation of Driving Miss Daisy.
Now, in playing the role, do you find that, especially doing it on doing something on stage night after night, different audiences, do you find that even each show is different because of audience reaction or the energy or vibe you get from the audience?
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, the audience is always another character in the play, really. The magical time is when you and the audience forget that you're doing a play. And the terrible times is when you're going, oh my gosh, they're coughing and they're moving around and you're unwrapping candy, they're bored. That's the nightmare on stage. But usually in this play, people are pretty, people love this play, and I do too. I never get tired of it. It's astonishing to me because you think of it as a rather light play, and it isn't. It's about very deep things. It's about love, it's about connection, it's about unconscious biases that we all have, and it's funny, it's touching, it's everything. This play has everything in it. He's a wonderful writer, Yuri.
Considering the fact that it is a play that deals with racial harmony, do you think it's even more important today with what's going on in the news than it was when it first was shown on stage or turned into a film?
I don't know. I think in a way, what it points out to us is that, we may think these issues have been dealt with, but they really, it's maybe consciously they have, but unconsciously we all, we find ourselves talking about all our little unconscious biases in rehearsal, biased about this or we're biased about that. Catholics don't like Episcopalians. You know, it's still present. You know, there's now it's radical Muslim, radical Islam. Whatever it is, there's bias in the world. Hmm. And we need to be aware of it, that's all.
The last time we spoke, which was 2011, you were very, very busy. You were coming to Canada again then. You were also stepping in for a short period of time on The Young and the Restless. And you were very, very busy. Are you just as busy these days?
No, I'm not. I am busy, but I really, this is the, I did a play just before I came up here in Los Angeles at a wonderful new theater, and this. But, you know, in this business, I had a few months where I wasn't doing anything except washing dishes and going home the groceries, which didn't make me happy.
What about television? Do you still get a lot of offers and opportunities to do TV?
No.
Not at
all? I don't.
That surprises me only because I know that, you know, as actors get older, there's less roles available for them. But conversely, we seem to be living in a day and age, especially with cable and Netflix, where there seems to be juicier, meatier roles written for all manner of spectrum, including older women. And I thought for sure somebody would snap you up because, well, you know, just your history and Emmy-winning actress that you are.
Well, thank you. That's sweet of you. But from your mouth to God's ears, I'm actually trying to develop a series that I don't really want to be, two, actually, and they're both quite different. But one of them deals with older people, which sounds very boring, but it's young people versus older people. So I'm hoping, I have a good feeling about that one. The other one is a little more complicated. It deals with, you know, my father was with the CIA, and so we're developing that one as well. But, you know, development is just development. It doesn't mean anything.
Right.
It's a crapshoot whether it's going to ever get on the air. But I'm not sitting around just needlepointing, you know.
Well, is there anything in your illustrious career that you haven't done that you'd like to do?
I'm trying to think. No, I mean, I think I've been very lucky. I've worked in I haven't done a lot of film. Maybe that would be nice to have some nice little juicy parts in films. But for the most part, I don't have kids now. I have nothing. I have a wonderful husband. I have a good life. And I still love to work. And I think you have to do that to keep, you know, to keep in shape and to keep young. You have to have something that you want to get up for in the morning. And so I'm very fortunate to keep busy.
I remember the last time talking to you, I asked you the question, which do you prefer, TV or stage? And you mentioned at the time that the pay for TV certainly is much better, but you enjoyed being on the boards. Is that still the same answer?
It still is. Oh, absolutely. And up here it's very nice because you go and you meet the audience in the, you know, in the lobby after the show. And at first I sort of thought, oh, I'll be so tired, but it's like meeting old friends, really, people who have watched The Waltons and or who came up and saw. Ralph and I did Love Letters. Maybe that's the last time we spoke.
Actually, when I spoke to you, when I spoke to you back then, you weren't doing Love Letters because that was coming up the following year. You were going to do that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So we did. Ralph and I did Love Letters here, and it was so touching. People, you know, he didn't want to meet the. He's a very shy man. Well, he's gone now. He was a very shy man. And he said, oh, no, I don't want to do that. And our producers very kindly and sweetly said, you know, Ralph, it's in your contract. And so he did. And after about the first couple of times, he just couldn't wait because people were so warm and some people had tears in their eyes and, you know, told him how much the show, the Waltons had meant to him and how... Some men were saying, my wife dragged me to see this, and I loved it, and now I want to start going to theater more. you know, just stuff like that. So it's wonderful to have contact with your audience. You don't get that on television.
And I'm sure
it is. You well know, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a warm feeling. Obviously, you see it on their faces. It's a warm feeling for the audiences as well. We should mention the dates. You'll be in Petrolia, Ontario, in Driving Miss Daisy, July 5th to the 24th, and in the special event called In Conversation with Michael Learned, July 27th to 29th. I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. It's a pleasure and an honor to talk to you once again.
Oh, thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Actress Michael Learned. She'll be at the Victoria Playhouse in Petrolia, Ontario, in Driving Miss Daisy, July 5th to 24th, and the special event called In Conversation with Michael Learned, July 27th to 29th. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0358, and you'll find links to the events. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. A federal inmate has filed more than 100 civil actions and lawsuits since he was imprisoned for dealing crack. He has sued President Obama, the U.S. Attorney General, and even the wife of a court clerk. All are handwritten and filled with profanities. But it wasn't until recently that a judge had enough and barred him from filing any more lawsuits. What was the last straw? Probably the fact that some of his lawsuits were filed on toilet paper. That's right, the toilet paper made the inmate's writing indecipherable, so the judge employed a seldom-used law that allows courts to ban lawsuits by prisoners who have filed 3 frivolous lawsuits. Let's be fair, balancing the right of all citizens to have access to the courts with the need to eliminate abuse of the legal system can be difficult, but I think this was an easy decision. Unfortunately, the judge's ruling only applies to the federal courts in Eastern Tennessee, and there are 93 other federal judicial districts. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder. But here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
Summertime and the living is easy, and it's also a good time to crack open a book. Stuart Nauman is here with another edition of Book Banter, Summer Edition. How you doing, Stu?
I'm fine, Peter. It's great, but you know what? Don't bring hardcovers. The sand gets in the spine and the binding. It's not fun.
I understand. I hear you. Yeah. And it also kind of wilts in the sauna, too, doesn't it?
Oh, it certainly does. So that's why you see a lot of paperbacks in the bookstores and in the magazine stores and the drugstores these days.
So I thought we'd do something a little different this time around. Rather than review books, we'll share kind of what our favorite summertime reading has been. So you start. What have some of yours been?
Well, I'm going back about a good 40 years worth, actually. I want to start with The Stand, which was Stephen King's blockbuster novel about the apocalypse, which was released in 1979. I read it in 1982, and not the original uncut version, but the cut version. That was still a good 800 pages. It took me 2 weeks to read. It was just, that book was so gripping, and I couldn't put it down. I loved that book.
Did that lead to other Stephen Kings for you?
Well, no, that was actually, I started reading Stephen King around 1979. I started with Carrie.
Okay.
Obviously, but and The Stand as well. But after The Shining. But after reading The Stand in '82, I just couldn't get enough of Stephen King. I was reading that, you know, every time he had a new book out, you know, I was like the first one to get it. Well, when it was in paperback, of course, because you know it was cheaper back then to buy paperbacks.
Okay, well, if we're going back that far, I'll toss in mine, and I won't bother reviewing them because I think everyone knows who they are, and they're mostly anthologies. I grew up with the Hardy Boys. I think everyone knows that. Agatha Christie, particularly Hercule Poirot. I love Poirot. I was also into a lot of short stories mysteries, so Hitchcock and Ellery Queen anthologies. But as an adult, I got into reading all of the James Bond books. I read all of Fleming's books in the order that he wrote them in. I also enjoy reading some of Raymond Benson. One of the reasons I liked reading Raymond Benson is because I became a fan of his and interviewed him several times, and we've had a friendly rapport, so I'm partial to him. And I was rather surprised by Kingsley Amis, who, under the pseudonym of Robert Markham, wrote the first post Fleming Bond book called Colonel Sun. I was surprised at how good that book was.
And that was a tough act to follow. I mean, by the time that book was published, Fleming was gone for 4 years already.
So, yeah, it came out in 1968. That's right. Yeah,
and it was still fresh in people's minds, the Ian Fleming book. So I guess he succeeded very well.
Yep. What about any others for yours into adulthood? What some of your summertime readings?
Well, I want to go back exactly 40 years. Okay. When I read, I started reading adult type books, you know, just around 1974, 75. But the biggest challenge for me was, it was exactly 40 years ago, about three weeks before the Olympics in Montreal, the opening ceremonies, and I decided to buy James Clavell's Shogun, which was like a 1,200 page book, and it was cost $2.75, and the average price was $1.95. And I gave myself a challenge to read this book about, you know, John Blackthorne, Lord Torinaga, and, you know, the way Japan was in around 1600 before, you know, Westerners decided to infiltrate Japan and explore it. And what a great story. I mean, Clavell writes with such historical accuracy, and it's such a sweeping epic. And I finished that book in about 2-3 weeks, actually. I really enjoyed Shogun. And I was 13 years old at the time, so it's like, what's a 13-year-old reading a book of this scale? So
okay,
I imagine defy the critics, so to speak.
Okay, but wait a minute. We're talking about summertime reading, and so far you've suggested basically two doorstops. Have you ever done any light reading in the summer?
Actually, 5 years ago, I read, I always like to read baseball books in the summer. And one that caught my attention was a book by Robert Weintraub called The House That Ruth Built. And it dealt with basically the first season, the Yankees' first season in Yankee Stadium in 1923. And even though the Yankees, were in the World Series, they did their first World Series appearances in 21 and 22, they won their first one in their new home in 1923. And that sort of set off the New York Yankees is a legendary franchise, and especially under Babe Ruth's and Lou Gehrig's talents. This was the year that started the New York Yankees as a legendary sports franchise, and what a great time to do it in their brand new home of Yankee Stadium. Great story.
If you're going to mention baseball books, I got to toss in three of them. The Umpire Strikes Back.
Yeah, late Ron Luciano. Funny
right.
Book.
Ball 4, of course.
Yeah,
and Nice Guys Finish Last.
That's a great trilogy. That's a great baseball trilogy.
Those are great books. Okay, I've always been partial to autobiographies. I'll mention my favorite autobiography of all time, Kirk Douglas's The Ragman's Son. He's since written several books. I've read all of his books, but still his first one is his best, The Ragman's Son. David Niven's two books, The Moon's a Balloon and Bring on the Empty Horses. And I like media autobiographies, so Sam Donaldson's Hold On, Mr. President, Linda Ellerbee's And So It Goes, which is my favorite of that genre, and Ed Joyce's Prime Times, Bad Times, which is the story of CBS. Those are great.
Oh, yes, and also when you talk about autobiographies, first one I read, like showbiz autobiography, was 1974. I read Charlie Chaplin's autobiography. It was published by Penguin Books. It was a paperback. I was in Camp Pembina in Saint-Donat, Quebec, and I got as a surprise, as part of the, care packages that parents send you, and I read it, just before I went to bed every night, and the book is so well written. I mean, it focuses more on Chaplin's early life and his Dickensian upbringings, the father was an alcoholic, mother went insane, how him and his half-brother Sid survived, and going into show business and, doing the music halls, going on stage, with Sherlock Holmes. The rest of his career gets sort of like a lip service, but I think the book really carries itself when Chaplin writes about his early years before even before he starts The Tramp Makes It Big. I think around before the period before up until 1914, 1915 is probably the best part of the book.
Okay, and we're just about out of time. Something current that you can say in about a minute, less than a minute?
Well, something current? Well, you know what? If you like autobiographies, one that's really catching a lot of attention is Shoe Dog by Phil Knight, the founder of Nike. And you want to know, I mean, hey, well, a guy who created shoes? Well, this is more than just, you know, a shoe company. This was a way of life.
Okay.
And he tells a story about that.
And I got to mention my favorite medical mysteries, Dennis Palumbo, who, you know, as you know, because of all the work I do, I do a lot of reading and research, so I didn't have a lot of time to do a lot of recreational reading, so that slipped for a while. I got back into recreational reading by reading Dennis Palumbo's From Crime to Crime, which was a thriller anthology series. And from that, I went into his Daniel Rinaldi series of medical mysteries. He's written four of them: Mirror Image, Fever Dream, Night Terrors, and Phantom Limb. They're all fantastic. It deals with a Pittsburgh psychologist. And very quickly, got to mention another doctor who writes books, a Canadian doctor, Dan Calla from out west. He's written Pandemic, which is a gripping book. Also Resistance, Rage Therapy, Blood Lies, and also Cold Plague, all fantastic medical thrillers. He's since gone on to writing historical dramas. I've read the first one, Of Flesh and Blood. He's got two others, which I haven't had a chance to read yet, but his stuff is fantastic and great summer read, great page turners.
Oh, yes. And so basically, you have our Remembrances of Summer Readings past.
Absolutely. Right? And how can people find you if they want to read you currently?
Well, you won't find me. I wish you could find me on Miami Beach right now or the Caribbean, but no, you can find me in the Montreal Times in print every Saturday or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart. Trying to get too much sand on your books.
Well, okay. Not easy. Let me tell you.
Stuart Nauman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. I just want to mention before we get to the climax of the show that we'd love to hear from you here at the Stuff File program. You know, you can send me an email with your thoughts or questions about the show and we'll respond. Promise I will. Just email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and some of the questions might even make it onto the air in our mailbag section. So, right in, okay? Also, you Facebook folks, I know there's a lot of them out there, you Facebook users, we urge you to join the Stuff File fan page. It's easy to find. It's at facebook.com/thestufffileprogram. We'd love to have you as part of the fun. The more, the merrier. And remember, this show is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, as I said, we're near the end of this program. The climax of the show, as it were. There's only one thing left to share with you on this edition of the Stuff File program. And you know what it is, boys and girls? Yes, it's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
53-year-old Damien Shaw was sentenced in England's Chester Crown Court in June after an April raid revealed that he had established a sophisticated cannabis-growing operation of 160 plants. Now, what brings his attention to us? Well, he set up his operation in a building about 50 yards from the front door of the Cheshire Police Headquarters. Now, why, oh why, would someone who is growing marijuana plants do it within spitting distance of a police headquarters? Well, one reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0358. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0358. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR in Nashville, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.